This podcast is intended for healthcare professionals outside the United Kingdom and the United States of America only. Welcome to the Medical Insider COPD by Boehringer Ingelheim, a podcast offering a breath of fresh air to clinicians treating COPD across the world. My name is Dr. Richard Russell. I'm a consultant chest physician at the Lymington New Forest Hospital in the United Kingdom, a senior clinical researcher at the University of Oxford, and also an editor-in-chief of the International Journal of COPD. I'm delighted to be your moderating host for this season of Medical Insider COPD podcast. I'm here to bring you news and insights in COPD right from the source directly to you. Thank you for joining us today. Be sure to subscribe and follow Medical Insider COPD to make sure that you do not miss any of the exciting podcasts in this series and the ones we've done before. Today, we're going to delve into a publication which I believe is well worth reading. This is entitled The Blood Eosinophil Count and the Development of Obstructive Lung Disease, the Kangbuk Samsung Health Study. We're also going to look at an emerging and exciting topic from social media, very relevant at the moment, COPD and the impact of fatigue on patients. But first, I'm absolutely delighted to introduce today's guest, and we're going to be discussing real-world research and real-world evidence and how this is impacting our treatment of COPD. With me to discuss this is Professor Antonio Anzueto from the University of Texas in San Antonio. Antonio, welcome to the podcast.
Richard, thank you for the opportunity to be with you to discuss this important issue in the decision on how should we treat patients with COPD.
So you're a researcher. You're also a guideline expert and a topic expert. What special criteria, special skills and experience do you have to talk about real-world studies, Antonio?
So, Richard, I've been involved with real-world studies for many years, and this, my interest was created in part because I saw there was a gap. Clinical trials published in highly rated journals will show us one part of the story. Certain randomized controlled trials have a highly selected patient population, but they not reflect the real life of the patients that I see in my clinic. So it's the need to understand how can we translate these clinical trials into what's going on my patients in their clinics.
So this is the key point, isn't it? You've nailed it there. What are the key differences between randomized controlled trials and the evidence we get from those, and then cohort studies and maybe real-world evidence later on?
So randomized controlled trials in chronic lung diseases and COPD, asthma, are a highly selected population. The strength is the randomization and void imbalances between the groups. So you need to look at the inclusion criteria, need to understand which are the patients who are involved there. In the other hand, having the real-world evidence that is obtained from analysis of real-world data, what you're going to do is you're going to bridge this gap. You're going to have meaningful endpoints. You're going to have long-term effectiveness data. You're going to understand medication use based on adherence and the patient able to take the medication. And at the end of the day, what is more important is patient-related outcomes. I can tell my patient, Mr. Williams, your FEV1 is 150% better. He will roll his eyes and say, I don't care. I'm short of breath going up the stairs. I cannot do anything in my life. So this is the translation on this and very exciting 150 mils into I can do more. On how can I do more on my daily life?
So, Antonio, when we read papers and we are looking at, say, randomized controlled trials, for example, what's the most important thing that we need to do to be able to actually interpret the study, to have them to see whether they're applicable to our patients?
You need to read the methods. You need to read the section, say, study population. Who were they? What medication were before the intro of the study? Were they had this washout period that they took them off of some medications? Are we having a selected population that had many exacerbations before? And that's why once you took medications away as some of those patients are going to behave much worse. So also is very important is how the analysis were done. What were the considerations that were taken to do the analysis that will lead into the results?
And are you aware of data that actually comes out quite differently when you take into account the complexity of real life patients?
Yeah, for example, we have recently publications of two large randomized trials that look at triple therapy, ICS LABA LAMA, ICS LABA and LABA LAMA. And the results were different. Just looking at the ICS LABA versus the fixed LABA LAMA combinations, it showed that the ICS LABA were actually really good and reduced exacerbations. But when we go into real world data, like for example, there is a recent publication by Dr. Quint that is an administrative healthcare claims from the US. It's a huge population, 61,000 individuals. Then they can identify the group who were ICS LABA versus the group that were a fixed LABA LAMA combination. And Richard, in this analysis, it clearly showed that the fixed LABA LAMA combinations had in the long term less exacerbations, less likely to require going up to triple therapy, and more important, less side effect from the inhaled corticosteroid. They were less likely to have pneumonia. So over there, we can see how it's impacted in real-world data what clinical trials were not able to demonstrate.
Let's talk a little bit further about actually real-world studies that are using dual bronchodilators particularly as examples of how to treat COPD. Because long-term, you've got to the studies like Jenny Quint's there, which was, as you said, a big database study based upon insurance claims. But also there are long-term cohort studies, which also look at people, as you've mentioned, longitudinally. So we can see the impact of changes to their treatment. And there's the DECORD study in Germany by Roland Buhl is particularly one of those that's done that, which shows that patients treated with dual bronchodilators early seem to not need extra therapy and stay stable without exacerbations. And I think there are others too, aren't there?
Yes. And I'm glad you mentioned the DECORD study because this is a very well-characterized cohort that have been followed. And I think having cohorts, and now we have these German cohorts, we have the COPD gene cohorts in the US, we have respiromics cohort, we have been able to put cohorts and follow them over time. And clearly in those groups, we can see the differences. In the study from the Ronald Ball study, we can demonstrate it that triple therapy was not better than fixed LABA-LAMA combinations. Patients of fixed LABA-LAMA combination had the same number of exacerbations. It was not better to increase into a triple therapy in a group of patients who had not had exacerbations before. And I think that is a very important point. Most of the individuals that we see, they haven't had or they have an exacerbation that was mild or moderate. In those individuals, they don't need to use ICS. Those patients, fixed LABA LAMAs, are going to be appropriate.
We've got the evidence. We've got randomized controlled trials. We've got cohort studies and real life long-term studies. But we need to talk about guidelines because it's through guidelines that we make recommendations that then implement findings from the studies. And you've been involved in several guidelines over your career. Are guidelines now beginning to consider real-world evidence?
I think it's fascinating to see how has evolved the guidelines. When we get stuck with grade and everything has to be on the grade, it will take 10 years to do the guidelines, will cost thousands of dollars. And then by the time we're able to publish that, say, oh my God, you know, what are we doing? We spend all this time, waste all this money, and we couldn't come up with any meaningful conclusion. In goal, it's one of the areas this has evolved, is the we come going into real world evidence, clinical studies. We're going into systematic reviews, meta-analysis, into taking into consideration that it has to be looking at the data from all the different aspects in order to provide meaningful recommendation.
And it's true that now the GOLD strategy and the European Respiratory Society and also the British national guidelines from NICE, National Institute of Clinical Excellence, certainly recommend as baseline treatment optimal bronchodilatation now. we need to do more with this, maybe?
Yeah, I think we need to emphasize that we have a very unique opportunity. We see the individual for the first time came to see us, he or she is symptomatic. We need to maximize the treatment because we need adherence. And in order for them to take their medications, they have to see the efficacy, that the medications are doing something for them. So it's a challenge as a clinician. It's not only to prescribe the medication, it's to be sure that the patient adheres to that medication. And if the patient feels the effect, it's going to stay on it.
So you've beautifully helped me move on to the next little bit of our discussion. You've got guidance and we've got patients that we need to influence. But we also, as healthcare practitioners, need to know the guidelines, know our patients, and know how to implement those changes. And there's been some great work published in European Respiratory Society Conference, also the American Thoracic Society Conference, showing, for example, that even within the United States, between states, there's enormous variation of prescription in COPD for the same kind of patients, particularly with an overuse of inhaled corticosteroids. Antonio, how do we deal with this?
The message is lost in translation. I think that's the problem. The message is lost because clinicians today are overwhelmed in their practices, especially primary care. They have to deal with many other conditions. The education and the challenge that we have today is we need to make respiratory conditions the front line to be important for them and emphasize that these are treatable diseases. That, yes, you can make a huge difference on Mr. Williams or Mrs. Johnson, if you give them the appropriate treatment, you will improve the quality of life. So I think it's education. I think it's important to emphasize that we do have treatments that are effective and appropriate for our patients.
So it's really important for us as respiratory professionals, those listening to this podcast, that we actually get out there, particularly talk to our primary care colleagues, and particularly spread the simple words about how to actually fairly straightforwardly, and I think GOLD is very straightforward, in how we should manage COPD to prevent deterioration and protect our patients, yes?
As a respiratory practitioners, we should lead by example. Our interventions, our therapies should be what is recommended by the different guidelines. So we should lead by example, treat our patients with appropriate therapies.
Okay, let's summarize then. What would you say, Antonio, are the key takeaways from this discussion?
I think the key takeaway is that we have to focus on how we're going to treat our patients. And in order to understand Mr. Williams, we need to look at the combination of randomized trials who give us information about safety, but fill this gap with real-world evidence that will show us long-term effectiveness, it's going to show us adherence, it's going to show us medication use, patient-reported outcomes, all these factors that are very relevant for our patients.
And we as a respiratory community need to keep on with effective education of all of our colleagues in primary care, particularly to get these clear messages across, right?
Yeah, we need to educate at every level. And more important, the message for education is this is a treatable disease. If we give the right medication, we can treat the disease. It's not that it's not real. You can change the life. You can change these patients forever if you give them the appropriate treatment.
Thank you for that. In a moment, I'm going to unpack this new paper for you by Haiyun Park et al., published in the European Respiratory Journal. But before I do that, let me thank my guest today, Professor Antonio Anzueto from San Antonio in Texas. Antonio, it's been lovely spending some time with you, and I look forward to seeing you very soon.
Thank you, Richard. It was a pleasure.
In a moment, I'm going to talk about an important and very hot topic in social media for COPD, the role of COPD and fatigue. But before I do that, let me unpack for you this paper. It's published hot off the press in the European Respiratory Journal 2021, volume 58, pages 2003 following, by Haiyun Park et al. It's entitled The Blood Eosinophil Count and the Development of Obstructive Lung Disease, the Kangbuk Samsung Health Study. This is a real-life study. It looks at a large cohort and has a long-term follow-up. And the question they asked was, is a high blood eosinophil count associated with risk of developing obstructive lung disease. They defined obstructive lung disease simply based upon spirometry. FEV1 less than 80% predicted with an FEV1-FVC ratio of 0.7 or less. They looked at people through their lives from around the age of 37 on average. These people had no previous history of any lung disease. And they followed 360,000 adults. They followed them up for about 5 to 6 years. This is over 2.3 million person years considered. 5,800 of them developed this definition of obstructive lung disease. And when you looked at all factors, particularly the eosinophil, there was a hazard ratio for increasing levels of obstructive lung disease with a higher eosinophil count. Smoking was controlled for and certainly did predict in some ways. But if you took out smoking as a cofactor, if your eosinophil count was greater than 100, between 100 and 200, your risk compared with those of less than 100 was 1.07. If your level of eosinophils was 200 to 300 cells per microliter, your risk was 1.3. And if your eosinophil count was between 3 and 500, your risk was 1.46. And over 500 cells per microliter, your risk of developing obstructive lung disease was 1.72. So what's going on here? Well, eosinophils are clearly important. We know they're important in COPD as a risk factor, but they're also important in non-smokers as well. When you take the eosinophil count, it seems not to matter. And it's unclear now whether these patients are developing COPD or asthma. And it's likely many of them are actually developing early COPD. So we can demonstrate changes over time, and the blood eosinophil may well be a thing you need to consider in taking together the risk of development of obstructive lung disease in the population. So we need to look out for it. Now for the delve into social media. What have COPD patients been talking about in the last few weeks? Well, they're talking about COPD fatigue. There's a wonderful social media site run by patients for patients called My COPD Team, which describes COPD fatigue as a major problem. Patients describing that this is my main problem and sleep is not the answer. They say that exercise makes us feel better, but really can add to the fatigue. So what's going on? Well, COPD fatigue seems to be the phenomenon that patients have where they describe the tiredness, the lethargy, the real inability to have energy to do things in the day. So what tips are available on these websites to actually help people? Well, there's some sharing hacks and things to help them deal with this fatigue in the real life. They felt that slow incremental exercise was a really good thing to do, regular light workouts. They also felt, and I think this is absolutely right, that there's a need for significant medical review because of the other causes of fatigue, anemia, heart failure, and other things that may be happening. They're also aware that temperature fluctuations can really affect their feelings. I think that's important too. And also advice about diets, light, energetic diets with slow-release carbohydrates rather than sugar-rich, carb-heavy diets. And then finally, they talk about the role of light. And actually the way that maybe vitamin D may affect how they feel and the fatigue and light and the fact that some of this may be hidden in seasonal affective disorder as well. So maybe you should look at your patients and consider, have they got COPD fatigue? Is this important to them? And what can you do to help about it? So thank you for joining us today on the Medical Insider COPD podcast. Look out for the next exciting edition, and I look forward to helping you further treat our patients with COPD better. Thank you.